Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are on one of our most targeted missions yet. We are trying to cut straight through, centuries of assumptions and tradition to get to one core question from the biblical sources. What is the single essential mark of a true follower?
And we aren't just looking at generic religious behavior here.
Yeah.
Our source material takes us right into one of the most, well, intense teaching moments in history. We're talking about Jesus's farewell address, the Upper Room Discourse, specifically in John chapter 13.
This is the core nugget, right? The final concentrated lesson given just hours before the defining moment. The sources really focus on the gravity of this. The audience was just 12 men, and one of them was, already a traitor. The stakes were incredibly high.
Absolutely. So our mission today is to distill what these sources define as the irrefutable evidence of discipleship. The one thing.
And maybe why that standard is, well, invariably harder than we ever let ourselves believe.
The setting just underscores that gravity, doesn't it? Everything else was stripped away. It's this intensely private, heavy moment where the declaration is made.
This is the standard that the world, the skeptic on the outside, is supposed to use to judge who is real and who isn't. And that quote, that standard, is right there in John 13, verse 35. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another.
That's it. That is the benchmark. And it's not a suggestion or, a hopeful thought. It's framed as the absolute external proof.
Okay, let's unpack that. Because what immediately jumps out from the commentary is this stark contrast. The true marker is mutual love.
Right. Loving one another inside the community.
And what's fascinating is what the sources systematically exclude. It's like a deliberate exclusion list, maybe designed to shock anyone who's relying on their religious performance for their identity.
Exactly.
So let's talk about that list, because the sources are crystal clear that the primary sign is not your church attendance, even if you've been showing up for
20 or 30 years.
Exactly. It's not about how much service you do. And this is a big one. It's not about holding a church office or a position. None of that is the definitive marker.
It's a seismic shift, isn't it? I mean, if the world sees you doing all those things, attending, serving, holding a title, but they see you being unkind or judgmental or just cold to people in your own group, the world concludes you are not a follower. The activity is, well, it's functionally worthless without the love.
But wait a second, doesn't that make the standard impossibly high? Are the sources saying that, structure and organized worship are useless? Because realistically, you need some organization to build the community where this love is supposed to grow.
That's a crucial question. And the commentary points out that the activities themselves aren't bad, but they are secondary. The message here was aimed directly at the legalism of the time. Think of Pharisees, who were masters of intellectual truth and ritual. But they often lacked practical, heartfelt love.
They got the truth in their heads, but it never made it into their relationships.
And the sources point out the real danger there. A religious life without love is genuinely dangerous.
How so?
It breeds jealousy, judgment, exclusion. I mean, historically, you see people persecuting others, causing wars, even terror, all tragically in the name of God. That intellectual truth without the application of love can make a person coldly ruthless.
It seems like this benchmark exists because that core love is the only thing the world is really looking for. It's the only thing separating a real movement from just another organization.
Absolutely.
So that brings us to the command itself from John 13.34. It's called the New Commandment. But the Old Testament already told people to love their neighbor. So why is this one new? What actually changed?
What changed was the standard itself. It moved from a general idea of neighbor love to something objective and externally imposed. First, the sources stress that this is a command. It's not a suggestion or a choice. It's an inescapable directive. You don't get to choose who to apply it to.
It immediately removes personal feelings or preference from the equation. You can't say, well, I love my way.
Precisely. And the phrase that makes it new is, just as I have loved you. That right there elevates the standard from a subjective feeling to a radical objective model.
So it means love according to my standard, not yours.
Exactly. And definitely not according to the world's self-serving concept of love. And that standard, well, it looks like action, not just words.
And the condition of that love has to be radical. It can't depend on whether the person deserves it.
Right. We often point to that line in Romans 5 that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. The love is extended when the recipient is doing absolutely nothing to earn it.
Maybe even when they're acting as your enemy.
Especially then.
Wow. I mean, that is the highest bar. And nothing shows that radical, almost impossible standard better than the example that's right there in the source material. Jesus' relationship with Judas Iscariot during those final hours, it's the ultimate test case.
The irony is just. It's almost unbearable. You have the traitor, the man who's already decided to betray Jesus for money. Yet, look at how Jesus acts toward him. The other disciples didn't even notice something was wrong.
He still invited Judas to the Last Supper. He still performed the humble act of washing his feet. And maybe the most jarring part, he offered him the piece of bread, a gesture of friendship, of intimacy, reserved for a cherished guest.
And the sources say this betrayal caused Jesus deep personal suffering. This wasn't just a political problem, it was a painful injury. Yet the love was still extended.
Even to the traitor.
I find it darkly fascinating that the text notes Judas was likely the most cultured and elegant disciple. He hid his malice behind perfect manners.
So the inward betrayal looked perfectly fine on the outside.
Right, which is why the others didn't suspect him at all.
It just highlights the impossible task we're given. If that radical sacrificial love was extended to the person actively plotting his downfall, what boundary are we allowed to draw?
Exactly. The commentary points to a core principle here. Enemies are not destroyed by revenge. They are eliminated by love.
You defeat the enemy by making them no longer an enemy.
And the only way to do that is to embrace them with that kind of unconditional grace.
That is a powerful idea. But if the command is to love that radically, where on earth do you even start? The command says love one another. It's relational.
It's a relationship. You can't do it alone. It needs proximity. You can't claim to love all of humanity if you haven't figured out how to practice it with the person right next to you.
So it has to start in the closest circle,
It has to.
which means family first, your parents, your spouse, your children.
Precisely. If you are cold or harsh at home, kind to strangers, but neglectful to your family, that claim to love is empty, according to these teachings. It starts with your immediate community.
The small group, the daily relationships where, irritations and differences are guaranteed to come up.
And when we talk about love in that community, the sources make a really interesting distinction. They say the focus has to be on the process of the relationship, not just on performance or results.
What does that mean, process over performance?
It means giving people permission to fail and still be loved. A community isn't a factory for perfect behavior. It's the place where we learn this difficult love, even though people are vastly different.
So loving others means accepting them as they are, without first requiring them to meet your standards. You can't try to fix people into being lovable.
It's accepting the whole package, flaws and all. And
Uh-oh.
that sounds, honestly, it sounds exhausting. This radical love is hard, and the sources admit that it leads to disappointment and injury.
Because you're dealing with imperfect people just like yourself, but it's still the non-negotiable command. It almost has to be difficult because it must require a supernatural strength, loving the unlovable.
This reminds me of that incredible story the source recounts about Corrie ten Boom. She survived a Nazi concentration camp. After the war, she was giving a talk in Munich, and she recognized a former guard, a man responsible for so much torment, who was there when her sister died.
Wow, that moment just encapsulates the entire challenge, doesn't it? The source describes her internal struggle. She felt this natural, overwhelming hatred. She thought, I simply cannot love this man. She was paralyzed.
Yet she knew the command to love was unconditional. She saw him walking towards her, his hand out, asking for forgiveness, and she felt nothing, no warmth, no capacity to forgive.
But she knew what the command demanded.
She did. So she chose obedience over her feelings. She followed the command to love the
What
unlovable.
did she do?
She forced her hand forward. She embraced him. And it was only after she acted in commitment that the feeling followed. It shows this love isn't driven by emotion. It's driven by a commitment to the divine command.
And this level of love, this is what changes the world, isn't it? If we connect this back to the global picture, the sources argue that the world today is materially rich. We have technology, goods, civilization. But it is desperately lacking genuine, authentic love, and that leads to profound loneliness and despair.
The commentary is emphatic. The force that changes the world is love, not technology, not social progress. The world has never seen true, unconditional love practiced consistently.
So the community where this love is practiced, even imperfectly, becomes the ultimate hope for a love-starved world.
Right. It shifts the focus entirely. from external achievements to internal character.
But let's get practical for a minute. How is that love actually defined day to day? The sources give a clear set of characteristics, sort of echoing 1 Corinthians 13.
It's so important to unpack that because they are the opposite of self-focus. Love is defined as patience. It endures when people are annoying you.
It's not about winning the argument.
Absolutely not. It's yielding. It lets the other person go first, even when you're justified. It is listening, even to words that might seem, you know, nonsensical because the person is hurting.
It means bearing another person's burdens.
Carrying their difficult life experience alongside them, not just watching them struggle from a distance. And ultimately, it means prioritizing the other person's benefit over your own self-interest.
Which is the total antithesis of how the world operates. This love demands you sacrifice your own comfort for someone else.
It's a complete reversal of self-focus. The sources say maturity is measured by how quickly you can pivot from your own interests to serving the needs of the person who's most annoying you.
So, to summarize our deep dive, the identity and maturity of a follower aren't measured by tenure or activity or knowledge. They're measured by the growth of their love.
A love demonstrated most clearly in the most difficult relationships.
The world isn't looking for better systems. It's looking for proof. It wants to ask, how can they love like that?
And the conclusion is this. Since the world has never really seen true, unconditional love, the kind that washes a betrayer's feet and embraces a tormentor, the community where this love is practiced becomes the ultimate expression of the faith. Our buildings, our structures, our doctrines, they're all secondary. The quality of our relationships, that mutual sacrificial love, is the only truly unique thing we have to offer.
And that's the challenge. It's not about waiting for someone easy to love. It's about starting with the people right next to you, the ones you currently find difficult, and beginning that hard process of obedience.
So the provocative thought we'll leave you with is this. If the world can only truly recognize a follower by the way they love, are you currently meeting the new standard? That standard demands we locate our enemies, or those who cause us the most pain, and love them until the enmity itself is gone,